Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Helles Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Emmanuel David, author of Women of the Storm, and G.K. Darby, publisher of The Bachelor in New Orleans. Emmanuel David is an assistant professor of women and gender studies at the University of Colorado, Boulder. He's the co-editor of the book, The Women of Katrina, How Gender, Race, and Class Matter in an American Disaster. Today, we're talking about his new book, Women of the Storm, Civic Activism After Hurricane Katrina. Emmanuel David, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you live in Colorado now, and you first came to Katrina research in the fall of 2005. But before that, you have a real tie to New Orleans, don't you?
Yeah, that's true. I went to Loyola, and I lived in New Orleans for those, you know, very formative years of my life. And I got to know the city really well when I was there. I lived on Jefferson Avenue and also on Marengo Street. And I loved riding my bike to the Quarterdam Coliseum. So, you know, I really have a lot of fond memories of living in New Orleans. And that's why, in many ways, when Katrina hit, you know, it felt like it hit so close to home.
Of course. So how did you get involved with Women of the Storm? Because you had a look at them early on.
Yeah, so when Katrina made landfall, I was actually living in Colorado working on my PhD. And the Natural Hazards Center here at CU Boulder sent me to do research on the recovery efforts that fall in 2005. And I really got interested in the stories of ordinary people who were coming together to rebuild the city. So in January 2006, I moved to New Orleans to write about the recovery and also to volunteer in the rebuilding efforts. And I lived there until the following summer. So at the time, I was living on the edge of Bywater on Poland Avenue near the Industrial Canal. And I remember opening the Times-Picayune one morning and seeing what was the first story ever written about Women of the Storm. And, you know, there was this photograph of three women. They were working around Ann Milling's dining room table. And they were preparing for their first trip to Washington. And that image is actually reprinted in the book. And so when I looked at it, I thought to myself, you know, this group is so unique. It's like any other group I've come across so far. And I thought, you know, it looks like a form of post-Katrina kitchen table organizing. Mm-hmm. And so it was at that moment that, you know, I knew I wanted to learn more and I wanted to study them. So the group made its first trip to Washington on January 30th, 2006 to lobby Congress. And a few days later, I contacted the court organizers. They invited me to the weekly steering committee meetings, which I attended for many months. And I began interviewing women at all ranks, those, you know, in the inner circle, but also those on the edges. And I wanted to hear their individual story. Now, because they had just gone on the trip, their memories were fresh, and they narrated the trip with such wonderful detail. So I used these interviews and other historical materials to reconstruct the group's formation and to tell the story of that initial trip to Washington, an event that, you know, in many ways shifted, I think, the entire course of the Katrina recovery. You know, the interviews are the real heart of the book, and I really wanted to focus on the meanings that participants gave to their experiences.
Now, most New Orleanians have some knowledge of this group, some awareness from extensive media coverage by now. Of course, there are the signature blue umbrellas, those high-profile trips to Washington to urge members of Congress to come and see, just to come and see, the damages from both Katrina and the BP oil spill. But you give us a real look at the behind-the-scenes organizing and the way that Women of the Storm reached out to widen its circle.
Yeah, that's true. Yes, I try to give a detailed peek behind the curtain. You know, what it felt like to be on the plane going to Washington, what it felt like to talk to lawmakers. And I wanted to focus on the everyday activities that made this group not only so effective, but also so compelling and so memorable. And, you know, the media reports, especially in the Times-Picayune, focused on those dramatic elements, you know, the images of the women marching on Capitol Hill with those bright blue umbrellas. So I, too, focus on those theatrical moments, but I also chronicle the day-to-day activities that made those moments possible.
And they certainly did their homework. They worked hard to prepare for all these things.
They really did. You know, they became political strategists. Some of them studied the voting records of each lawmaker. They read up on the bios of politicians. They prioritized meetings with lawmakers on important subcommittees. They made spreadsheets with charts and graphs. So they went to Washington prepared, you know, to make the best case that New Orleans was worth saving. And it was important for me to chronicle these day-to-day activities. There's a thread, I think, in the book that focuses on women's work and their invisible labor. And the women I spoke with, especially those in the core circle, they invested incredible amounts of time and energy and also emotion into Women of the Storm's activities. So you're right, they did their homework. They learned the ins and outs of Washington politics. They memorized the important facts and figures of the recovery. They put a great deal of thought into how to best present the plight of New Orleans to politicians.
And they did a great job, I think. Now, you're also looking at them in sociological terms as what you call an emergent group and as a study of race, gender, and class. So I want you to talk a little bit about what you learned from them in that way.
Sure. So I learned that Women of the Storm really did not emerge in a vacuum. You know, it didn't come out of the blue or out of thin air. In effect, the group was a culmination of decades worth of philanthropic experiences of those working in New Orleans, but also in other parts of Louisiana. So Ann Milling, for example, the group's founder, you know, she had been involved in community work for many decades prior to the storm. She was involved in the Junior League, a primarily white women's organization. She was involved in Catholic Charities. She volunteered at the Lazarus House, a care facility for people living with HIV/AIDS, and she helped organize Pope John Paul II's trip to New Orleans. So, like Milling, there were also numerous African-American community activists who participated in Women of the Storm. I'm thinking here of Leah Chase, the queen of Creole cuisine.
Of course.
And many, many of these women were involved in groups like the Lynx Incorporated, an important Black women's civic organization. So when I think about race, class, and gender, I think, you know, it's important to think of the significant contributions, too, of women of color who were present at all ranks of the group. Here, you know, I'm thinking of the leadership of Madeline West, of Dolly Simpson, both of whom served on the group's steering committee. So like Milling, like Leah Chase, each and every woman brought a wealth of experience to the group. And I think they were part of this long history of women's activism in New Orleans, and I tell some of these stories and trace some of these connections in the book. What is most notable, however, is that the storm created this rare opportunity for many of these women to work together for the first time, to cross the boundaries of race and class, and to work together for a cause they deemed important. So I talk about this in the book through the concept of bridge work and crossing racial and class divides. So throughout all this work of Women of the Storm, I learned that diversity and inclusion were important goals. And though there were definitely some asymmetries in the group's composition, inclusion was nonetheless a goal that they strove for in self-conscious and self-reflexive ways.
And they really came up with such incredible ways of getting their messages across. I think not only about Ann Milling's straightforwardness and mastery of the facts, and I think of the emotion of Cecile Thibault, for example.
Yeah, that's true. You know, the goal was about telling many of these women's stories. Cecile Thibault, Karen Kirstings, you know, she took oil-covered shells to Congress after the BP oil spill. So I can't thank you enough for saying that, because the book is really about the individual stories of the women within the group. I began to see the collective and individual stories as intertwined. And so when I was writing this book, I made the decision to profile a number of women to show that their individual struggles with Katrina coincided with the activities of Women of the Storm, and that those stories were actually inseparable. Cecile Thibeau is a great example for that very reason. I document part of her life because her struggles with the storm played out so publicly. News crews accompanied her return to her flooded home. And, you know, these were quite devastating stories. And she transformed these feelings of devastation. She redirected them into something more positive and more productive. And I like her story because she began writing, she found her voice. And I think Women of the Storm created similar avenues for participation for these women to take on a new role in the public and new civic role.
So much of this, I think, is great storytelling, you know, when you're doing research like this, just to sit there and listen to them. I think a lot of New Orleanians have that great memory of sitting somewhere else and watching Seal on TV going, "We are not okay." It still gives me goosebumps to think of it. So the great thing about this book is that not only does it tell the academic story, but it also sings with the real life of that time. In the end, do you think it was mission accomplished for this group? What do you think we've learned about how to go forward?
I think they accomplished what they set out to do. Women of the Storm convinced many lawmakers from around the nation to visit the destruction. Their lobbying efforts helped pass important recovery legislation dedicated to wetlands and coastal restoration projects. And in the wake of the BP oil spill, they were instrumental in helping pass the Restore Act, which redirected a percentage of civil penalties from the spill to funds for ecological and economic restoration. What I think readers will learn is that this work wasn't always easy. It took an incredible amount of labor to achieve these goals. There were lots of obstacles and letdowns on the way to their successes. So, for example, their bid for a debate for the 2008 presidential election wasn't successful. And that's an important part of the group's history. And it was important for me to include that in the story as well. So I think we could also learn that there was this individual sense of accomplishment and satisfaction that came from participation, a greater sense of political engagement, personal efficacy. One woman described her participation in Women of the Storm as her finest hour.
I'm sure. And one of the things you talk about at the end of the book is the idea of moral selving and the type of moral agency that women felt doing this work and as a result of it as well.
Yes, that's another important layer to this story. So while the immediate focus on the book is about rebuilding places like New Orleans in the wake of disaster, I learned that there were other types of rebuilding or rebirth taking place. So by engaging in civic activism, the women I spoke with were attempting to reconstruct their moral identities, their place in a post-Katrina world. Their participation helped them rebuild their own sense of who they were, and it also allowed them to think more expansively about what kind of people they wanted to be. So as much as Women of the Storm was about collective actions to steer society in specific ways, both after Katrina and after the BP oil spill, this work was also an effort to craft lives with meaning, lives with direction, and lives with a sense of purpose. Women of the Storm created one such avenue for these women to direct their creative energies, both towards the betterment of their communities, but also the betterment of their selves.
And we are lucky for them. And in this time when women are speaking out about so many issues, this is especially inspiring reading. So thank you for that. We've been talking with Emmanuel David about his new book, Women of the Storm, Civic Activism After Hurricane Katrina. Emmanuel, thank you so much.
Thanks, Susan. It was my pleasure.
G.K. Darby's Garrett County Press has brought us some wonderful reprints of New Orleans classics, including the fabulous WPA Guide to New Orleans. As much fun to read now as it was when it came out the first time. Now he's back with a new project, The Bachelor's Guide to New Orleans by Robert Kinney, with illustrations by Eugenia and Bob Riley. GK, I'm so happy to welcome you to The Reading Life.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thank you.
So this book was originally published in 1942, and I've only seen it one other time. So tell me how you came across it.
Well, actually, I was working on the WPA guide. I came up with the great idea that we were going to start from scratch with the WPA guide, retypeset everything, find the original photographs. It was actually a horrible idea, but it took a long time. Spent a long time at the historic New Orleans collection looking through old WPA photos. And one of the times I was there, one of the librarians came up and said, "Have you ever seen The Bachelor in New Orleans?" No. They went behind the desk and brought out this absolutely gorgeous, very rough, linotyped, woodblock printed, like colors that were just leaping off the page. I just really couldn't believe it. And I started flipping through it. It was a wonderful art book, but then I started reading it and I just couldn't believe how well written it was and how funny, humble, and interesting. And I was like, well, at some point we should reprint this.
Well, it's such a pleasure to look at. I mean, it is so lively and every page, I mean, there are lots of ads in here, and even the ads are incredibly beautiful.
That's right. I mean, it was a real, I doubt it was a real moneymaker, but I think that was the intention. There are ads for The Court of Two Sisters, Pat O'Brien's, Tony Bacino's, really beautiful works of art that I assume the authors sold as ads to these various bars and restaurants.
So it was published in 1942. What were you able to find out about the people behind it?
Well, I know that Bob Riley, who is the artist, and Eugenia Riley, they were a couple, lived in the French Quarter and ran this studio. And I found a newspaper clipping from 1938 that said, "Artist Bob Riley buys the lattice building in the French Quarter on Royal Street." And some people call that building the skyscraper, the French Quarter skyscraper. It's absolutely gorgeous building that no artist would actually have the money to buy. So I don't know where. That's all I know about Bob Riley. I also know that the book was linotyped. And are you familiar with linotype machines?
Well, I am, but for people who aren't.
Well, there are these two-ton monster Rube Goldberg contraptions,
yes,
where, you know, type is spilling everywhere. There's a vat of molten metal at 500 degrees, and then there's a typewriter, and the person sits at this thing, types the manuscript out, and all these clanking wheels and everything happens, and then a line of type comes out at the end. It was one of the craziest contraptions if you've ever seen one in person.
And it could have done some serious damage to a building like the skyscraper.
Well, yeah. So that I know two things: that he bought this gigantic building in the French Quarter, and that he had a two-ton machine with hot molten metal somewhere on the first floor making this book. You can tell that it's letterpressed. That was one of the struggles that we had when we were going to reprint this book, is should we start from scratch like we did with the WPA, or should we keep the feel of it? So I went to this photo retoucher. We had to do a lot with the images to restore them, and we came up with the idea that we were going to keep the type. And so we had to scan the book at this enormous resolution, and so not to lose the noise, but we had to fix it up so it didn't look horrible. Mm-hmm. So we went back and forth, and it only took us 10 years to get it right.
So were you able to find anything out about the author?
The author, no. No obituary, nothing.
Wow. Maybe somebody will come forward now who knew him. Wouldn't that be great?
That would be wonderful. I know your listeners are very knowledgeable people. And so it would be wonderful if someone reached out and told me who Robert Kinney was. I mean, he's obviously a very funny person.
Oh, yes. Oh, and loves New Orleans like so many people do.
Loves New Orleans, is married, keeps apologizing.
Yes.
for drinking too much.
So tell about some of the topics this covers.
So in the beginning, you sort of get a standard survey of what it's like to eat and drink in the French Quarter. Then it moves into sort of more eccentric, interesting topics about how you shouldn't be a tourist. The authors and that exist in the French Quarter, it covers the subject of loneliness and of the art colony in the French Quarter. It really moves into almost these little short stories. There's an extended story in there about how it's almost impossible to leave New Orleans.
That was one of my favorites.
Yeah. Written in the second person, so it's like you may get a last drink, and then your last drink may turn into many last drinks.
Yes, you may.
Yes.
You might need a last drink if you do all the things in this book, I feel sure. One of the things I love about this book is that there's a chapter called The Bachelor is Bookworm.
Well, yes. He has some wonderful descriptions of the booksellers in the French Quarter that I think hold up to today. And there's wonderful listing of the authors who were here, like Walt Whitman and Faulkner.
It's just interesting to me how that's taken for granted as something you should cover in a book like this. That's one of the reasons I love it.
Good
you know?
Point.
And there's even a nod to the bacheloress, the female bachelor.
Oh, yes, definitely. It's an equal opportunity guidebook.
Now, what do you think about this in the context of the long line of books that have contributed to New Orleans' lascivious reputation? You know, you have the Storyville Blue Books. You've got this book. This book tells you how to tell a prostitute from a regular girl in a bar, which is a very fine point when you think about it.
Well, I guess I'm a little biased in that I find this book moves away from the sort of nostalgia that some other books express regarding our sort of sordid past. I think it's very factual and honest. It's really a celebration about having fun. And it's really a book that is just sort of bursting with life.
What do you think, for example, is the best advice in this book?
Well, the best advice, I think, is don't be a tourist.
Yes.
And that's right in the front of the book. Don't be a tourist. Be kind to people that you meet. There's a whole section in the book about things not to do, to be a jerk. And it's a book that really has a lot of sympathy for the people in New Orleans. And the place beyond tip your bartender, find the places that are off the beaten track and enjoy them.
Well, the whole message of this book seems to be surrender. Surrender to the spell of the city. You know, it's there waiting for you.
It's true. And it's unconventional in that way.
Well, I think it's very special. And I'm glad it's back for people to read. We've been talking with G.K. Darby, who's the publisher of the new edition of The Bachelor in New Orleans by Robert Kenney, with wonderful illustrations by Eugenia and Bob Riley. G.K., thank you so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Books have inspired some surprising songs. Sometimes, a song inspired by a book looks deep into a process. Danish singer-songwriter Agnes Sobel was inspired by Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow to write The Curse for her 2013 album, Aventine.
The people went to their I-A-O-R. From the start, they didn't know exactly why. Came, made it so look alive, underneath the grass would grow, aiming at the sky.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me now of the very soul. Look alive, look alive. Do you know the stranglehold covering their eyes? If I call on every soul.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. First, some reading life news. Starting December 31st at noon, the show will be doing its first airings on Sunday. We'll still be on three times a week, Sunday at noon, Tuesday at 1:30, and Wednesday at 8, so keep listening. Room 220 presents readings by Brad Richard, Andy Young, and other local authors, Monday, January 1st at 6 p.m. at Antenna Gallery on St. Claude Avenue. One Book, One New Orleans has narrowed down the shortlist for the 2018 selection. The three books are The People's Grocer, John G. Schwegman, New Orleans and the Making of the Modern Retail World by David Capello, Roll With It, Brass Bands in the Streets of New Orleans by Matt Sacchini, with artwork by Willie Birch, and New Orleans, A Food Biography by Elizabeth M. Williams. Check out the Facebook page for One Book, One New Orleans for info on voting for your choice. The deadline is January 6th. The January 2018 New Orleans Writers' Workshop Intercession Semester begins January 3rd. The workshop, an adult writing program taught by trained published authors, is offering four-week and one-day courses covering creative nonfiction, revision, dialogue, and jump-starting your writing. They'll be in locations around the city all throughout January. All skill levels are welcome. This short session is meant to keep you writing until the full nine-week semester starts after Mardi Gras. Visit NewOrleansWriters.com to register. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.